This is WNHN FM 94.7 and WNHNFM.org. You are listening to Statehouse Watch. I'm Arnie Alpert.
And I'm Maggie Fogarty. We're from the American Friends Service Committee, New Hampshire program, bringing you our weekly Statehouse Watch radio program. Statehouse Watch is a companion piece to our weekly Statehouse Watch newsletter, where we explore in some depth some of the issues being addressed by our state legislature, broader state government, with a special focus on policies and programs that relate to the well-being of our New Hampshire communities. And we are in a unique format now and for some indefinite period of time, as all programs for WNHN are being recorded remotely. So this week's show will be constructed of interviews that Arnie has done with some New Hampshire leaders from different sectors, from the state legislature, from civil liberties, from public health arena, so that we have multiple perspectives on these times that we're living in New Hampshire as we address the COVID-19 public health crisis that we are living in.
Maggie, our legislature is still on break. The notice says they are on break at least until April 10th. And basically, there's no business being conducted at the State House at all as far as committees or meetings go. And the last calendar from Speaker Shurtleff, I thought implied that it might go beyond that. I mean, it still says April 10th. There's nothing else that's scheduled right now. So they're going to have to extend their deadlines out for getting legislation through and getting to the end of their session, which they thought was going to be the first week of June. So obviously something's going to be different, and we don't know, and perhaps they don't know yet what that's going to be.
That's right. And whatever we learn from places, including in the United States, some major metropolitan areas, the state of California, the state of Washington, certainly the arc of response to this disease is not a short-term, let's do something for 2 weeks and we'll see enough results that we can stop doing it. So I think all of us are learning as we watch that we are very likely to be in a suspended state, in a state of some restriction for some time in order to respond effectively to this. The stakes are too high to be half-hearted or casual about our behavior. So
that's right. The state is under a state of emergency right now, declared by the governor, I think on March 13th. The authorization comes out of RSA 4:45, Chapter 4, Powers of the Governor and Council in Certain Cases, Miscellaneous Provisions, State of Emergency Declaration, Powers. And so far, the governor has declared the state of emergency, and then he has issued about, I think, 10 additional executive orders. The most recent one has to do with ordering people not to bring your own bags to the supermarket or when you're cooking, but to use fresh ones that they will provide. They are apparently out of concern of personnel within the supermarkets and other retail establishments that people could be bringing the virus in with them.
Yes, I had a neighbor go into the grocery store yesterday with her own bags, as is her habit for many years. And because the news was just making its way out to people, lots of folks showed up unaware of that new restriction. And the store clerk asked her to go back to her car with her bags and put them away, not even to leave them unused in her grocery cart. So, just the new detail. And I hope folks are responding willingly to these requests, even if they seem a bit small or strange. We do want to center the well-being of people who are having to go out into the workforce every day, while many of us have the privilege of working from home or are being told not to go to work. There are large numbers of people who need to show up so that people can continue to buy groceries and medicines, et cetera. So we want to be responsive to what they're asking for to feel safe.
Great. Later on in this show, we'll be talking with Jeannie Holt, a public health nurse. We'll be talking with Devin Chafee about the civil liberties implications of this current crisis, and we'll also talk with Casey Conley, a state representative from Dover, about the challenges of being a legislator. In fact, and Casey's also, as you know, Maggie, a specialist on the shipping industry. So he sees things that are going on that most of us probably are not that much aware of. If you want to follow the governor's executive orders, go to the state website at nh.gov. You can both link on the state's COVID-19 resource page, which is maintained by the Department of Health and Human Services. You can also go to Governor Sununu's page, where he lists the executive orders and other news. I have found, Maggie, that when he's going to have a news conference, the best place to find out about that usually is on Twitter, and they will post a link to usually WMUR was broadcasting the last one, and New Hampshire Public Radio has put some of them on Facebook Live. So if you want to get the news right away as it's breaking from the governor, those are good places to go to watch it as it happens.
I see conversations in a number of communities among city officials, with messages. I saw a message this morning from the CEO of Exeter Hospital, some consideration being given to shelter in place as a possible necessary strategy to further limit the behaviors that people are engaging in that could be unknowingly spreading the virus. So we'll be certainly paying attention to that, trying to help people understand those steps if they are taken.
Now, Maggie, you've been paying particular attention to issues affecting immigrants who are detained in the country, but specifically at the Stratford County House of Corrections. What kinds of actions have you been taking?
Yes, thank you. So over the past couple of days, the New Hampshire Immigrant Rights Network and our close and overlapping partners, the New Hampshire Immigrant Solidarity Network, sent a sign-on letter to the heads of the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, as well as the U.S. Customs and Border Protection, insisting that as a fundamental part of effective and meaningful public health response to COVID-19, that they cease enforcement activities in immigrant communities. We have cause for some hope from a statement from ICE last week that they would be limiting their enforcement activities, but they included a reference to wanting to continue with regard to people accused or charged with crimes. And we know over the last from throughout the Obama administration, that reference to immigrants who have been charged with crimes has been a horrible catch-all for continuing aggressive, terrifying activity in immigrant communities. We have criminalized so much in the way of being out of status for immigrants that phrase has become somewhat meaningless in terms of any kind of limitation. But more importantly for New Hampshire people, our letter asks that they release all civilly detained people at the Stratford County Jail, for their sake, for the sake of the entire jail population and the employees. So we await response on that.
And we'll keep you posted on our show next week when we think we will do this again. If it worked this time, let us know by getting in touch with us. You can find us on Facebook at American Friends Service Committee NH Program. You can find us on the web at afsc.org/NH. And you can communicate with us through the website, through the Facebook page, or emailing us at afsc@afsc.org. And of course, you can stay attuned to this radio station broadcasting 24 hours a day at wnhnfm.org or 94.7 in the Concord area. Let's go out with a message from the Ndlovu Youth Choir from South Africa, something that everybody should pay attention to. And we'll be back with Representative Casey Conley. Corona. Yes, it is. Corona. Casey Conley, welcome back to State House Watch Radio.
Oh, well, thank you for having me, Arnie.
Yeah. Casey Conley is a state representative from Dover. He's also a member of the Young Democrats Caucus. And Casey, that's really an area where you've been a leader of trying to make the legislature adapt to the different needs of younger legislators, which I don't know, from my perspective, must mean like younger than 60.
So I am one of around 30, about 35 members of the House. It's been an extremely active caucus this year, and our members have done have been behind a lot of important things. Bills around capping the price of insulin. Many of your listeners might have heard that the smoking lounge has been closed. There was a real effort by Representative Fox. So there's been a whole lot of stuff that our caucus has been involved with for the past year.
Great. When I saw that there was legislation to make the smoking lounge child friendly, I thought that that was pretty bizarre. I thought that they were going to have a smoking lounge with children in it, but I misunderstood that. So I was glad when I got straightened out about what that actually was, and glad to see that that legislation is progressing in the legislature.
Yeah, for sure.
That's fabulous. Casey, you went from having a couple weeks ago, there was an all-nighter. The Speaker of the House was just racing to get through the agenda. Maybe he thought that this kind of lockdown was coming and wanted to get through things very fast. But you went from there to a day or 2 days later to being told, in effect, to not come back at all. What was that all-nighter like, for starters? And also, what's it like to be told to stay away from the State House?
The all-nighter, there's been a lot written about it. There's been a lot of discussion on social media. It was a pretty grueling experience. We were there until 3:53 is when we finally broke. Something like 150 bills to address in one day. And in a normal day, we maybe get through 40. We definitely saw the writing on the wall. We knew that the pandemic, it had already been declared a pandemic at that point. We knew that the legislature was about to take a long hiatus. So it was important that we finish those bills. It's also worth noting that we don't really know what the future holds for the rest of this session. The legislature is on a long pause right now, along with much of the state, the country. So all those bills that we've done, that the Senate has done, and there are a number of bills still pending, it's just really unclear how those get resolved with, you know, an emergency status that we're in right now.
Well, right. We know that we've told our listeners and State House Watch readers about the suspension of all business until at least April 10th. But the last message from the Speaker really kind of hinted that it might go longer than that. So one of the things that the legislature did, both the House and the Senate, on your last session day was to approve the ability for the leaders to be able to change the deadlines, because that's one of the things that drives the busy agenda at the State House, is an agenda, a deadline for crossover, a deadline for when committee reports have to be, and all this stuff, in order to be able to be done by the first week of June, which was what the intent. So I certainly don't have any idea, Casey, about whether the session will just get pushed off into the summer or what's going to happen.
Right. I mean, that's the big question. And legislators have been talking amongst ourselves, you know, texting each other, calling, messages on social media. We don't really know, because as you know, and as many of your listeners know, once changeover happens, all the bills from the House go to the Senate, and then there are all new public hearings scheduled, and vice versa. And every bill in New Hampshire gets a hearing. So the process could take some time if we're going to maintain this model we've used for many years.
Right. And the rules are that you really have to meet in person. Is that correct?
It is. And I don't think there's much appetite for changing that. And I don't really know how you would. I mean, we have members who don't use email. We have members who are reluctant to really make these kind of changes. And I don't think we really have the infrastructure in place to go virtual. I mean, you and I are chatting over Zoom. We can't do that with, 390 House members.
Right. And then with all the members of the public being able to watch, right?
That too. Yep.
Our right to know law, all the public's business has to take place in the view of the public for people to be able to listen to it.
Right.
That's another element of this that is affecting not just state government, but affecting local government at all levels as well. They're trying to figure out how to handle that. Now, Casey Conley, in addition to being a state legislator, in addition to being a parent, you are, as a journalist, are also pay close attention to the shipping industry. So I'm very curious what you've seen in terms of how the pandemic is affecting shipping. We are all, in a sense, dependent on the transportation infrastructure being able to function during this crisis.
I mean, it's still functioning. It's functioning differently. I was in Seattle at the end of February when this pandemic really started to hit home in the U.S. and was talking at that time with ship pilots. These are the folks who board ships from other countries and guide them into U.S. ports. There was a lot of concern. Pilots were rightfully anxious about boarding a ship where someone from East Asia might have a cough. You know, is it a cold? Is it something more serious? That said, the business of shipping is continuing. There are places in our country, even Hawaii and Alaska, that get the absolute, you know, 90%+ of all their goods from ships. Those ships need to continue going. Otherwise, those states would run out of supplies within a week. So fortunately, that industry is continuing, but it's like everyone else, it's not functioning. There's just a level of concern that about how it will move forward, I guess, would be a good way to think about it.
Yeah, Casey, are they developing new protocols for how to handle goods and also how to interact with each other as workers?
You know, I don't know. And our magazine is focused on the U.S. industry, and the U.S. shipping industry is a very small piece of the world shipping industry. And it's also each flag state and each port is going to operate a little differently. But it's safe to say that the precautions that people who are in going about their regular life about keeping distance, wearing masks if you have them, sanitizing your hands and washing hands, all that is happening on ships. In fact, again, going back to that discussion in Seattle with the pilot, there are people that even back then, people, as soon as they boarded, would try to wear a mask, but they found that it was hindering their ability to communicate. So the masks had to go basically by the wayside. But and another interesting thing is from that is that if the foreign sailors were, they were worried about picking something up in the U.S. So they were trying to protect themselves and vice versa. So it was something everyone's aware of. But as far as protocols, I'm just not aware of any.
Well, I'm sure you'll be keeping an eye on that and you'll let us know. Before we let you go, Casey Connolly, I want to ask you, one of the things you've been following is the issue of the craft alcohol business in New Hampshire. So could you tell us a little bit about that and what is special for that in terms of how it's affected in this times of pandemic and physical separation?
So as many of your listeners will know, there are, you know, numerous craft breweries in the state, cideries and so on that employ thousands of people. They rely on getting their product out to bars and restaurants primarily. So with many of those restaurants now closed and doing takeout only, there's an effort, a bipartisan effort led by Representative Prout of Hudson, basically to change the restrictions around who can fill a growler, which is a 64-ounce, essentially, jug. So currently, breweries or cideries would fill these on premises only. So the concept, and something that I think we've asked the governor, we will be asking the governor to do, is allow restaurants with taps, just any place that wants to do this, to fill it. Or to fill these growlers as a way to keep demand flowing for these smaller producers. Because as you can imagine, when restaurants close or when restaurants stop serving people, demand stops. The idea is just it's one way to potentially create, you know, a way to keep these businesses going, even on a reduced capacity until we get through this crisis.
That's interesting. So would you be asking the governor to do this by executive order?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the way we're leaning. And this is new to all of us as well. And right, as you would expect, the officials in Concord who we would get guidance on this are busy taking care of other things. But the general idea is things we can do to help businesses, this being a very small piece of that, are things we should be looking at and taking action on quickly so we can prevent very serious economic hardship for a lot of companies.
All right. Well, as we look at the powers of the governor and executive council in the cases of emergency, which is governing the state of emergency and enabling the governor's initial executive order declaring a state of emergency, one of the changes in his powers is the ability to relax various kinds of regulations and licensing requirements. So it looks like if he wanted to do this, he probably could, and that would be helpful to the craft brewing industry. So that's a very interesting thing. Casey Connolly, we wish you the best to you and your family and your constituents. Keep an eye on the shipping industry for us and let us know what you're finding so we can pass that on to readers and listeners of State House Watch. And we're going to go out with a song about the transportation infrastructure with Taj Mahal.
Babies, sweet Georgia overdrive.
You are listening to Statehouse Watch Radio on WNHN 94.7 FM in Concord and on the internet at WNHMFM.org. I'm Maggie Fogarty. Join my colleague Arnie Alpert for an interview now with Devin Chafee, Director of the American Civil Liberties Union New Hampshire Program.
Devin Chafee, welcome back to Statehouse Watch Radio. Devin, last week, together with the New Hampshire Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, the ACLU of New Hampshire sent out a letter which says New Hampshire public officials should heed public health experts' advice and take steps to protect individuals in the criminal legal system who are at high risk of severe illness or death from COVID-19. And that includes, as I understand it correctly, both people who are incarcerated, but also people that are subject to arrest. So if you could tell our listeners a little bit more about your concerns, about your statement, and if there's any responses you've got.
From our perspective, from the ACLU's perspective, we are most concerned with some of the populations in our state that are most vulnerable during this COVID-19 epidemic. We're particularly concerned, therefore, about people who are incarcerated or who may be incarcerated, people who are involved with our criminal justice system. These populations are highly vulnerable, in part because they are obviously in close quarters, which puts them at great risk, and they're often in poor health to begin with. So populations of individuals that are incarcerated at this time are particularly at risk for infection, and then they are limited into what types of treatment and testing and screening that they may seek as well. So it's very important that during this time we not forget about those most vulnerable populations in our state. So what we are calling for is that all individuals, all stakeholders within the criminal justice system here in New Hampshire take deliberate and smart steps to try to limit the risks that these populations are at. All jails in the state, of course, we have 10 county jails in the state of New Hampshire, should be releasing sort of public plans of action so that residents know what steps are being taken on their behalf, and so that residents' loved ones and families and friends also know what steps are being taken on their behalf. Part of the other recommendations that we're making are simply recommendations to ensure that we are not incarcerating a single person here in New Hampshire unnecessarily during this pandemic. So when we have, there's no need to add to the problem by increasing the people who are incarcerated, who are at great risk, if there isn't an absolute need to. And so this takes could take a number of forms. One is that we are calling on prosecutors to reduce the number of people that they are seeking to be incarcerated pre-trial. So these are people who have not yet been convicted of a crime. If an individual does not pose a clear risk, a clear safety risk to the community, then there is no reason then that person should be detained pre-trial at this time. And so we're asking prosecutors to take those steps.
We have too many people who are in jail for reasons which do not actually do much to protect public safety.
And I want to be clear. We continue to support the bail reform measures that have been passed. There are some modifications to those bail reform measures that are currently before the state legislature that we support and will continue to support. But in addition to those measures that have been taken that should be in place over a long period of time for long-term reform to our criminal justice system, there are additional steps that should be taken on a short-term basis to address the crisis that is happening now and to reduce the number of inmates that are in custody during this pandemic. So we're saying that yes, stakeholders involved with the criminal justice system should go a step further during this pandemic to ensure that people are not being incarcerated unnecessarily. And that includes, you know, looking at things like daily reporting programs. Are there people that, instead of being incarcerated could be, you know, out, but reporting in daily, which is something that we're urging jails, county jails, and the Department of Corrections here in New Hampshire to look at more closely. We're looking at whether or not the parole board can be more effectively and more aggressively using medical parole. The statutes here in New Hampshire do allow the parole board to use its discretion to allow people out on parole if they meet certain criteria that would be medically necessary. And in here in New Hampshire, we have one of the oldest prison populations in the country. And so really, we think that the parole board and the Department of Corrections should be looking at those people who are in their custody, who are over 65 or who are immunocompromised, and seeing, you know, should some of these people, at least for the time being, be granted a medical parole in the current circumstance. This requires a coordinated response across the stakeholders that are involved in our criminal legal system. And obviously, police are the first point of contact there. And police have a good deal of discretion. You know, if someone is simply, you know, this is a repeat offense for a trespassing offense or some other type of violation where in normal circumstances, where the person doesn't clearly pose a threat to the community, maybe under normal circumstances, they would be arrested because, this is not the first offense. Maybe now is not the time to be bringing that person into custody and to subjecting that person to potential additional risk by bringing them down to the police station and having all of the various contacts that would be required with an arrest. Instead, you know, we are calling on police to really be more thoughtful in how they are making those decisions and more deliberate in thinking about the public safety more holistically.
Devin, have you gotten any response yet from anybody in the court system or the police system or the jail or prison systems to your letter?
Yes, we've gotten a very positive response from the Department of Corrections, and we know that they are taking a number of different steps to try to both reduce the number of individuals that are in their custody that might not need to be there, as well as to protect those individuals. So, for instance, we know that they are reviewing who could potentially be released on home confinement during this time. So there's an active review process that the Department of Corrections is taking on. We know that they're moving from doing parole check-ins in person, which obviously caused more risk when you have a parole officer actually going to an individual's house and meeting with that person face-to-face. That doesn't allow for the type of isolation that we're all being asked to do. And instead, they're doing those calls by phone check-in, which is another safety measure that they're taking. And they're also limiting the types of parole violations that they would then bring somebody back to the prison. So when somebody is out on parole, they can be then violated for that parole for a technical violation that isn't even really a violation of the law, but is simply a violation of the terms of parole and then required to go back to the detention facility. And so right now, we know that the Department of Corrections is looking to try to limit parole violations so that they aren't unnecessarily bringing people back into the prison system simply for a technical violation of their parole when that's not necessary.
Well, Devin, this is an interesting time of crisis, and perhaps when we get through it, we will have learned some things that we can continue to apply to end this whole era of mass incarceration that we're in. Here at the American Friends Service Committee, we've just sent a letter to ICE and the Border Patrol, and also sent letters to the officials at Stafford County Department of Corrections, because Stafford County Jail functions as an immigrant detention facility. And those immigrants who are being detained in ways that really does nothing to protect public safety, but subjects them to greater risk and subjects corrections officers to greater risk, those people ought to be released into the communities and to be back with their families. So we've sent that letter out as well, certainly consistent with the type of position that the ACLU has taken here. I want our listeners to know that the ACLU letter can be found on their website at aclu-nh.org. That's a great place to go for ongoing information. Devin, I want to ask you about another question, because when I hear about a state of emergency, the first thing that I think about is what does that mean in terms of threats to civil liberties? So I'm curious how you've reacted to the governor's state of emergency, and for that matter, to President Trump's state of emergency.
Well, I think it's really important to keep it into perspective. You know, a state of emergency can be used in all different types of ways. So what we're really doing, what we're waiting and watching for and looking for, is how are the powers being used during this state of emergency? And specifically, are they being used in a way that are scientifically and medically supported? Are they proportional to the risk to the public? And are they really the least restrictive means to protect the public? And that's what we are going to be looking for throughout this crisis. It is clear that some pretty significant measures are warranted in this particular crisis to protect folks and to make sure that they are not, to reduce the medical risk to individuals and to the public. But what we want to continue to watch for is, are the measures that are being taken, are they supported by the science? Are they supported by the CDC or the Center for Disease Control and what the Center for Disease Control is recommending? Are they supported by what physicians are recommending is the best way to protect the public? And that's what we're going to continue to look for.
Last week, a group of people in New Hampshire actually challenged the governor's executive order limiting gatherings of 50 people or more, claiming that that was infringement on their constitutional right to freedom of assembly. Obviously, that's a principle that the ACLU believes strongly in. How did you see that lawsuit and the judge's decision to, in effect, just throw that out?
Well, I will say that we were not that surprised that lawsuit was unsuccessful. The freedom of assembly, while an absolute essential constitutional right, it is subject to certain reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions that a public health emergency makes a reasonable restriction. So there can be, it's not an absolute right. It's not a right that is simply applied the same in all given circumstances. So given the current situation, there are certain restrictions that can be made to the right to public assembly that will be seen as reasonable. And again, I think what really comes into play here are do the steps make sense given what the purported outcome is? Given that the purported outcome is to protect the public health, are the steps that are being taken, do they make sense? Are they necessary? I think that the court, not surprisingly, found that the steps that have been taken thus far to limit public assembly are in fact necessary in this time.
Devin, in RSA 4:45, which states the emergency powers of the governor in certain cases and enables a state of emergency to be declared, one of the provisions in it that certainly made me look was where it says that the governor has the authority to perform and exercise such other functions, powers, and duties as are necessary. Well, that is an extremely broad, sweeping, vague category. So how do we assess that as it goes forward? How do we know, and what do we do if we believe that the governor is taking on powers that he ought not have?
We need to be focused on what's actually happening and what steps are being taken. So, and looking at whether or not the steps that are taken are actually necessary if they're supported by the science. We will keep a very close eye as things develop, to see what other measures may be taken. One of the greatest concerns is when it comes to elections. And whether or not at both the federal and the state level that the executive branches are going to make sure that we are prepared to move forward with elections in a timely manner. And that is something that we are watching with eagle eyes on.
Well, Devin Chafee from the ACLU, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us on State House Watch today. We're glad that you are watching our civil liberties, and we are going to continue to encourage people to go to your website at aclu-nh.org. to get updates on what's going on. You are listening to Statehouse Watch on WNHNLP. I'm Arnie Alpert. In these times of physical distancing, we're all trying hard to maintain our social connections. I'm grateful for the workers in the telecommunications sector who are keeping our phones and all our devices in operation. Here's a song from Chuck Berry and one from the Grateful Dead.
Long distance information, give me Tennessee, help me find the party, try to get in touch with me. She could not leave her number, but I know who placed the call, 'cause my uncle took the message and he wrote it on the wall. Help me, information, get in touch with my Marie. She's the only Texas, the polls are out in Utah.
got to find a private line. You could be hanging around a steel mill, working in a house with blue lights, riding a getaway bus out of Portland, talking to the night. I don't know where she's going, I don't care where she's been, long as she's been doing it right.
You are listening to Statehouse Watch Radio on WNHN 94.7 FM, streaming on WNHNFM.org. This is Maggie Fogarty with the American Friends Service Committee. Stay tuned while my colleague Arnie interviews Jeannie Holt, a public health nurse in Manchester.
Jeannie Holt, welcome back to Statehouse Watch Radio. Good to have you on again.
Thank you. Good to be here.
But Jeannie Holt, you are a public health nurse. You live in Manchester, and you're on the board of the American Public Health Association. Let's actually just start out by telling us, what does a public health nurse do in normal times, and then how has that changed in a time of pandemic or public health crisis?
But let's take one step back from that first to kind of set the foundation of what is public health. If we think of the health of a community as kind of like a building, and a building really depends on having a strong foundation, and that foundation has to be built over time with quality planning, design, materials, quality personnel doing the building, et cetera. And that foundation is public health. A well-built building then can withstand a hurricane or an earthquake, and a community with a strong public health foundation can be resilient in a time of crisis like what we have right now. As a public health person, I think about what are the strengths of our public health foundation, and then what are the gaps or the areas where the foundation is weak and needs to be rebuilt, reinforced as we come out the other end of this pandemic crisis. So you asked, what does a public health nurse do in normal times? Well, you can think about the variety of health-related issues that we might think about. So there's chronic disease. So a public health nurse works in chronic disease prevention and chronic disease management. So, for example, doing diabetes prevention education in the community, working with groups of people on managing their diabetes themselves rather than having to constantly be dependent on a medical doctor or going to the emergency room. If they can learn to better recognize how to manage their diabetes or their asthma or whatever, then it puts less stress on the healthcare system. So prevention, management. So infectious diseases is another area of health issues that public health nurses work with on an everyday basis. And part of that, again, is educating people on, you know, how do you wash your hands? What are the ways that infectious diseases are transmitted? How do we break that chain of transmission? Public health nurses also investigate disease outbreaks. So in the past year, I think I read the statistic from the State Health Department that we've investigated 200 disease outbreaks before COVID-19 hit the scene. So a nursing home has a bunch of people who end up with vomiting and diarrhea. Then public health nurses will step in and investigate, how did that start? How is it getting transmitted? How can we stop? How can we break that cycle? The other part of infectious diseases that public health nurses work on is vaccines, doing clinics, doing vaccine education. Of course, at this point, we don't have a vaccine for COVID-19, but when we do, public health nurses will be the ones that really try to get that out there, organizing clinics so lots of people can get immunized and prevent the further spread of that.
How does this change in times of emergency like the current one?
Well, obviously, in a time of emergency, it's all hands on deck. And so anybody with that works in public health will be involved in whatever is needed. Part of the planning around emergency preparedness is figuring out how you structure an emergency response. And that will then provide the guidance on where the public health nurses are going to plug in. In this particular case, a lot of the public health nurses are plugging into organizing mass testing, which isn't going very well in this country, but in other countries, public health nurses would certainly be much more involved in the drive-by testing, for example. As the in early in the pandemic, public health nurses would have been involved in tracing contacts and helping people understand why they needed to stay home, how to self-quarantine themselves, how to get the services they need. Public health nurses tend to be a link between a lot of pieces of the system.
Obviously, public health nurses and other healthcare professionals are on the front line right now in treating people and working in prevention, but also are people who are themselves at great risk of exposure to the virus. Can you say anything about how that's looking from your perspective right now? We're hearing about nationwide shortages of the kinds of equipment that are necessary for workers to be able to protect themselves.
In general, nurses overall are very, very dedicated to the work of being a nurse and will tend to put aside their own concerns and their own, even put aside their own health to provide service to in nursing. But I do know that nurses are concerned about how do they continue to serve their communities and provide for their families.
Could you say a word about the American Public Health Association? What is its role?
Our role has tended to be kind of twofold. One is making sure that the science is accurate, is understandable, is that the interventions that are being funded are effective. The other role is to take the science to the policymakers and help policymakers to make good policy decisions. So taking the science, for example, around if we increase the age of tobacco purchases to 21 years old, the science, we can take the science to policymakers and show that that's really going to cut the rates of smoking and ultimately then cut the healthcare costs in this country because fewer people are going to have the sequelae of becoming addicted to cigarettes. So taking the science and translating that research into something that policymakers can get a hold of and can figure out how to make good public health policy.
Have the policymakers been paying attention to your advice?
You know, I think that we've had much more success on the state and local level than we had on the federal level. And I'll come back to Tobacco 21 as an example of that. That started in local locations in Massachusetts and has spread across the country and has tended to be adopted at local and state levels rather than at the federal level. Within the American Public Health Association, we also have a state public health association that's affiliated with the APHA. And every state public health association has been involved in state level policy as well as at the national level. I do think that at the national level, we've been somewhat successful in the past in helping policymakers understand the impact that their policies are going to have on public health. Doesn't always mean that they make good choices around public health. There are always competing interests, but that's been an important role. And throughout this pandemic, the executive director of the American Public Health Association is a highly respected emergency preparedness doctor, and he's been called on a dozen times a day for information from the media, from policymakers, from researchers, from organizations to help them understand what needs to be done and how to move forward.
Are there two or three main points that are coming out of the organization right now that the rest of us would benefit from hearing?
I don't think there's anything coming out that you aren't hearing in the broad media. Certainly the social isolation and how to cope with that. Certainly the importance of hand washing. And then probably a little bit more behind the scenes is talking about, well, how do we get into a situation where the public health system was weakened to the point where we're really struggling to provide the services that are needed to make this public health crisis, to mitigate the crisis that's going on. And so how do we, as we look forward, how do we better ensure that in the future we can strengthen that foundation of the building so that we can withstand these kinds of crises. So one of the things that you had asked me earlier, Ernie, was what are people who are always thinking about public health thinking about right now? And two of the things that I would say that are on our minds, first of all, of course, how to best serve our communities. But in normal times, we are already seeing a lot of what we're calling diseases of despair. We're seeing the impact of social isolation before the pandemic started. And what we're worrying about is, you know, suicide, addiction, depression, all of those social isolation issues, health issues, are likely to worsen. And how do we mitigate the further impact of social isolation? The other thing that we're worrying about is, even in normal times, we are not effectively addressing the health impact of poverty, of racism, of xenophobia. And so we in the public health world are very worried about how much worse, how much more inequity are we going to see, how much more injustice are we going to see as a result of this this pandemic, of the blaming that's going on, of the racism, the xenophobia against Asian, anti-Asian phobias that we're beginning to see. So those are issues that are kind of in the background while we're busily trying to serve the communities through the pandemic.
Great. Well, we are certainly grateful for groups like the American Public Health Association, which has a sterling record at looking at issues like the impact of racism on health. And we look forward to getting more information about that from you as this goes forward. Jeannie Hull, is it too early to be able to cite some of the lessons that we're learning in the current crisis?
You know, that's an interesting question, because I think that what we're learning is something that public health people have known all along. It's a matter of how do we help people understand what we already knew so that the general public learns it. You think about when public health is most effective, nothing happens. Okay, so if we had been a super strong public health system worldwide, we wouldn't have had a pandemic. But that's invisible. And so that's really hard for people to say, okay, I'm going to fund something when I don't see anything happening as a result of it. And what we're hoping is that we can come out the other side of this and then help people look back and see, oh, here are the places that if we had, for example, good public health depends on relationship. Relationships don't happen overnight. Relationships aren't something that we can say, oh, there's a pandemic coming next week. We need to build a relationship. That relationship has to be there and has to be strong to be able to very quickly mobilize the trust and the actions that are needed. So when we get to the other side of this, hopefully we can look back and say, okay, we need to put the time and invest in creating the relationships, creating the systems, doing the planning that's necessary so that when an emergency happens, we're ready for it.
All right. Well, Jeannie Hull, thank you so much for sharing that with us. We look forward to seeing you on the other side of this crisis and repeating what are some of the lessons that we've learned so that we can have public policies that can help us be more resilient when the next crisis comes along. Thanks for being with us on State House Watch.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to State House Watch Radio. Be sure to tune in next week, 5 p.m. on Mondays, 8 a.m. on Tuesdays, or streaming online at WNHNFM.org. And in the meantime, wash your hands, take care of yourself.
take this away. Going where the climate suits my clothes. Going where the climate suits my clothes. Going where the climate suits my clothes. Down the road, feeling bad. Going down the road, feeling bad. Going down the road.